Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. The preamble to the Constitution lists the foundational purposes for the establishment of the United States of America. Second on the list is, quote, establish justice. And when the founders drafted the Bill of Rights, they included this, the Sixth Amendment, quote, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury. At times in our nation's history, we've failed that sacred guarantee. For many decades, it occurred when African Americans and other minorities faced all-white juries. It also happened when people with unpopular political or religious views were charged with crime. And a strong case can be made that it happened in Miami, Florida, in the trial of five men accused of conspiring to commit espionage for Cuba. They were convicted, and 14 years later, four of the five remain in prison. Here to discuss the case is William Morris, a former prosecutor and Miami lawyer who represented one of the defendants. We invited the U.S. Department of Justice, which prosecuted the case, to join in the discussion, but they've declined. Bill Morris, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up outside the United States. My father worked for the government, and I grew up in foreign capital, so I feel right at home in Miami. My father was involved in the intelligence community for the United States and spent his entire adult life doing that.
What did you take from that experience growing up in that family in that international setting?
It's a remarkable world. I grew up principally in the Middle East, and we drove from Tehran, the capital of Iran, to Beirut for a weekend at the beach. And the 4th Armored Division couldn't do that today.
Why law school for you?
I decided to go to law school when I was in the Army in the Republic of Vietnam. And it was the result of a tremendously complex set of factors, but it basically boiled down to the fact that I was troubled by the complete control of the rank structure in the Army over my life. And I wanted to be something where it didn't make a difference whether I was a private, a sergeant, or a general. I wanted to be a person who was able to make his own decisions and do what he thought was best in any given situation.
And you've been practicing law for how long?
Since 1973.
Would you say your hopes and expectations have been fulfilled?
There have been many dead ends, many false turns, but as a general rule, I think the answer is yes. I've chosen a career path that's made me very happy, has given me a lot of very positive feedback, and I think generally, when I look at my body of work, I'm pleased with it.
You've been both a prosecutor and a defense attorney. Why both sides, and how is it different for you?
I used to think that defense and prosecution were opposite sides of the same coin, but they're not at all. I started as a prosecutor because the career path that lets you become as good as you're able to become is fairly clearly marked. And once I had achieved kind of the top of the heap as chief narcotics prosecutor for Florida and the Caribbean, I had pretty much done everything that I wanted. And I felt that the job had really become too easy and it was becoming repetitious. So I switched over to the defense side, which is totally unstructured. It's like being on the high wire on the trapeze without a safety net, and I enjoy the challenge.
That sounds like a satisfying career. Did you ever consider alternatives?
Yes, I did. A number of years ago, I ran for countywide political office as a Republican.
How did it go?
I lost. I told people that I had fallen on my head and had learned something from the process.
Let's talk about the case. How did it come to your attention, and why did you decide to defend one of the five?
They came to me. In this case, all of the defendants had court-appointed counsel, and one of the five people who were appointed could not get past the background security check.
By that, the lawyers had to pass a security clearance because of some of the evidence?
The discovery was classified information. And you had to have a security clearance to even go into the room where this information was being kept. and they went looking for someone who already had an existing top secret clearance. I did. They came to me, asked me if I'd take the case, and I said yes.
Why did you say yes?
It seemed like a fascinating case. It was totally atypical. This is a district where fraud and drugs are the bread and butter of the federal courts. This was something that I had never encountered before.
Who was your client? What was he charged with?
My client was charged as John Doe, and they gave him the name of Luis Medina, which was the cover name that he was using in Miami. His true name is Ramon Labanino.
And he was charged with?
The principal charge was a conspiracy to commit what we call espionage. He was charged with a conspiracy to act as a spy.
Was he a spy?
Only in an extremely broad sense of that term. To violate the statute, you have to gather and transmit information that relates to the national defense. And he was not doing that. He was not gathering or transmitting any classified information. The information that he was gathering and transmitting was publicly available, the things that you could see out in the general public or that you could read in the newspapers. And his principal purpose was to keep an eye on the Cuban exile community who and those people in that community who were responsible for bombings that were going on in Cuba.
If I understand you correctly, he was an agent of the Cuban government then, spying on or keeping track of elements of the Cuban exile community.
Correct. He was an employee of the Cuban government, and that's what he was doing.
You said in your summary he was watching groups that had carried out attacks on Cuba. What do you mean? What are we talking about here?
There were, in the late 1990s, a series of bombs placed in tourist locations in and around Havana, principally in the hotels in downtown Havana that were frequented by tourists. And what he was doing was trying to find out who was doing that and pass that information on to the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
I thought you just said he's working for the Cuban government, spying on or watching as an intelligence guy activities of the Cuban exile community, and I thought I heard you just say passing that information on to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You mean the American Federal Bureau?
The American Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is charged with enforcing various laws that make it illegal to run an operation in the United States to blow up hotels in a foreign capital.
I apologize for going over this again, but this is like trying to hit a curveball. Is it fair to say this is somewhat unorthodox?
It may be unorthodox, and the conclusion that the effort to curry the support and favor of the FBI may very well have led to their exposure, because there's no question that this organization was totally infiltrated by the FBI. We learned during the discovery process that the FBI was doing periodic searches of their homes and their computers. And the reason for it is that the Cuban government has no way that it can protect itself or its hotels from the activities of the small element in Miami that wanted to disrupt the tourist industry in Cuba.
You're listening to Home Ground, and we're discussing the case of the Cuban Five with Bill Norris, defense attorney for one of the defendants in the trial. We invited the Department of Justice, who prosecuted the case, to participate in discussing it. They declined. What evidence is there that the FBI actually used some of the information provided by this network of agents?
One of the items of information that they passed on to the FBI related to a boatload of explosives. It was on the Miami River, and the FBI or some branch of law enforcement, I presume the FBI, were able to successfully intercept that boatload of explosives.
Now, the boatload of explosives, again, coming from a small segment of the exile community aimed at doing something in Cuba.
That is correct.
obviously the FBI is doing two things. They're infiltrating the group, knowing what they're doing, monitoring them, using some of the information to interdict violations of American law. Suddenly that shifts.
What happened internally is a matter of pure conjecture on my part. I have no idea why suddenly they decided to prosecute criminally and sentence ultimately for long periods of time these individuals, because it's not the normal traditional response to this kind of activity.
When you say normal traditional response to this kind of activity, what are we talking about?
To explain what I mean by this type of activity, it's a relatively low-level information gathering, which every country, not perhaps every country, but many countries, including the United States, do in foreign countries. And what these five people were doing was low-level information gathering. Now, clearly, if someone is involved in a very sensitive position in the Pentagon or the White House and are intercepting very, very critical information, that's a different situation. When I say this sort of case, I'm talking about this low level of information gathering.
That's a serious statement of your personal judgment. What's it based on?
It's based on my lifetime as a citizen and a daily reader of the newspaper that's informed by where I grew up, the house that I grew up in, and the activity in that house. So I've watched this kind of activity and our legal response to it over the years.
You said they were sentenced to long prison terms. What are we talking about?
My client was initially sentenced to life in prison until the sentence was reversed, and then he was resentenced to 30 years in prison.
Reversed on appeal?
Reversed on appeal.
Okay. He is currently serving 30 years in prison?
He's serving 30 years in prison.
Now, I've taken some time to look over what is, for me as an attorney, I'm not a criminal lawyer, but a voluminous record, multiple appeals. It's too much to discuss here. The central allegation, it seems to me, if we can boil it down, is the fairness of the trial. Did these men, charged with conspiracy to commit espionage, and in one case, I think, conspiracy to murder, get a fair trial?
No, they did not get a fair trial.
Now, why do you say that? When I ask you the question, I used to be on the Board of Corrections in California. I did an investigation into prison gangs, and most guys in jail will tell you they didn't get a fair trial. They got a bum rap, etc. So it's a common complaint. What do you say to people that say, sure, didn't get a fair trial?
I say to them that Miami is different. And Miami is different because of its geography and because of the people who live here, and the political experience of the people, of many of the people who live in Miami.
How does that relate to this trial?
It relates to it in the fact that everyone knows that Key West, just down the road, is 90 miles away from Cuba. But after the revolution in Cuba that brought the Castro government into power, many of them came to Miami.
Cubans?
Cubans. They're now Cuban Americans. But they carry with them the experience of exile. And these were people, many of them, in positions of power, authority, and privilege in Cuba. They've lost it all, and many of them bear legitimate resentments against the Cuban government.
Let me see if I understand you. You're saying you have a revolution in 1959. There's a lot of emigres that leave the country, angry as hell, as they were in China and post-Vietnam. They come to Florida, and here's a trial, you're saying, 40 years later, that is not fair because of the environment in Miami. That sounds like a stretch.
The question of whether it sounds like a stretch really goes to the heart of the judicial review of this case, because if you're outside of Miami, you're not aware of how intense the feelings are here. Remember that Fidel Castro, who led that revolution all those years ago, is still in Havana, Cuba. And it's his brother who's running the country.
And in 1999, he was in charge.
In 1999, he was very much in charge. Mm-hmm. So the attitude here was not that this is ancient history, but that this is history which day by day, provocation after provocation, is reinforced. And the angers, the resentments, the hatred of the Cuban government that is pervasive in Miami receives daily reinforcement.
What are we talking about?
The Cuban exile community has done everything that they can to push back against the revolution, to change things back to the way they were. And of course, the Cuban government responds on its side. And so that you have all sorts of anniversary dates that are remembered every year, where there's been some kind of minor explosion between the two sides that's been provoked by one thing or another. And with respect to this case, the most critical one is the February of 1996 shoot down of two aircraft who were out patrolling for an organization called Brothers to the Rescue, and the death of four airmen.
Shot down by the Cuban Air Force?
The Cuban Air Force shot them down with MiGs. The Cuban government's view of this was that it was an infringement on their territorial sovereignty, and they responded very much the way the United States government would be if you tried to fly three aircraft over the White House or over the Capitol in Washington, D.C. They responded aggressively. They had made many, many efforts over many, many years to stop overflights of Cuba by the Brothers to the Rescue. Now, the Brothers to the Rescue have a tremendous emotional pull on the Cuban-American community in Miami because they were doing humanitarian work. They were flying, trying to identify and help people who were fleeing Cuba to come to the United States. And they were identifying where they were. They were dropping them water. They were dropping them food. But what happened was the United States government and the Cuban government came to an accord where people who were picked up by the Coast Guard would get shipped back to Cuba. With this really kind of did away with the justification for the Brothers to the Rescue, and they went on to other things which turned out to be provocation.
You're listening to Home Ground, and we're discussing the case of the Cuban Five with Bill Norris, defense attorney for one of the defendants in the trial. We invited the Department of Justice, who prosecuted the case, to participate in discussing it. They declined. If I understand your side of the argument, you're saying that this reaction to this shootdown, on top of everything else, was so intense that it fundamentally affected the fairness of the trial. Is that your position?
Yes, it is. And the most apparent reason for that was that the families of the four people who were shot down attended every single day of the seven-month trial. They were in the courtroom every single day. But what was going on behind the curtain, if you will, turned out to be far more pervasive and far more damaging. And that was a steady propaganda effort in the United States, in Miami, in Dade County, a use of the Office of Cuban Broadcasting.
That's a federal office?
It's a federal office that was chartered, like the Voice of America, to bring about regime change, to change the Castro government in Cuba, and by doing that with propaganda.
My understanding, though, is that that operation, like Radio Marti, for example, is directed at Cuba, or was directed at Cuba, and it was against the law for it to be directed internally to the United States, correct?
That is correct. In the case of Voice of America and the other branches of it, they are prohibited from any domestic dissemination of their propaganda message. In the case of the Office of Cuban Broadcasting, since Cuba is just down the road, they prohibit anything except incidental.
Okay, but if it's prohibited, then you're arguing it affected the trial, so there's some incompatibility here.
Totally, and that's part of what it is that we're currently litigating about this case. The principal problem is that the Office of Cuban Broadcasting was paying journalists in Miami who were then repeating the same story that they were telling for foreign propaganda purposes in the newspapers in Miami. The publicity was intense. There were hundreds and hundreds of articles during the course of trial, and on the average about five a day. And to measure the impact of these newspaper articles, you have to remember who the audience was who was reading them. That Miami is part of Dade County, Florida, which is heavily Cuban-American.
What does heavily Cuban-American mean? What are we talking about?
We're talking on the order of 700,000 people out of a population of 1.5 million.
Okay, but if you have careful selection of a jury, the idea is you can have jurors who are selected to be impartial, correct?
No. That was the myth about the jury selection process that permeated appellate review of this case.
Appellate review of this case meaning what?
The three-judge panel that originally reviewed this case reviewed the defense contention that you couldn't get a fair trial in Miami, and they agreed. They reversed the conviction. A three-judge panel in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, Georgia, found that this case represented a perfect storm.
Those are their words?
They used the words perfect storm in the opinion, and they pointed out the strong forces that came together to create this perfect storm. And those strong forces were the understandable prejudice or preconceived ideas of the Cuban-American population about the activities of the Cuban government. The panel opinion, which ran 93 pages long, and it was 93 pages filled with footnotes and detail, talked about a couple of major points. And one of them were surveys that had been done of the Cuban community, which showed some 500,000 people had specific recollection of being forced from their homeland by the revolution. And thousands who had recollection of relatives being killed by the revolution. So that these are not minor or transient thoughts or feelings or prejudices which are lost over time. And in this particular case, the media in Miami was refueling on a daily basis this existing prejudice. The panel opinion found that no matter how careful the jury selection process was, and indeed it was careful, you cannot isolate the jurors sitting in this case from the environment in which they sit. They breathe the air every day. And in Miami, that air is permeated by a deeply seated, deeply rooted, unchangeable feeling that Fidel Castro is the most evil of all men, and his government is the most evil of all governments. And anyone associated with it cannot be innocent. We don't care what the proof is. We feel that since the fact of association with the Cuban government is enough to justify conviction and a lengthy jail sentence.
Now, that three-judge panel decision was then appealed to the full 11th Circuit, and they reversed, saying, correct me if I'm wrong, that you could get a panel of impartial jurors even in this atmosphere.
That is correct. The en banc court, all of the judges sitting together, said that the trial judge had done everything that she could and her jury selection process was a model for other judges to follow.
And your view of that?
My view is that I think that the judge did everything that she could, but you cannot get the smell out of the courtroom. The reality in this community is that it doesn't matter whether you're Cuban or Venezuelan or, in my case, from New England. You absorb through the pores the truth of the matter that Castro is evil and Cuba is evil. And I had absorbed that over the almost three decades that I've lived in this town, and I wasn't even aware of that until my first trip to Havana, Cuba.
Let me ask you this. You've prosecuted cases, you've defended cases. In the trial itself, were there things that happened that you felt, as a lawyer, that were patently unfair?
There are two examples that come immediately to mind. One was the fact that these people were being tried as going after classified information. They never received any, but the jury was given book after book after book of documents that were taken from the defendant's computers that the FBI had stamped secret on the top.
Was it secret?
The documents included copies of articles out of the Miami Herald. Nothing in it was classified. It was classified by the FBI as part of their investigative process, When the documents were given during trial to the jury, simply a line had been drawn through secret. It was still readily apparent with the notation that it had been declassified.
So your point is what? That this influenced the jury's mindset?
The subliminal impact in a classified information case is overwhelming. Nothing that the defendants ever had was ever classified by the United States government until it was seized from the defendants, and then it was classified as secret. The second example dealt with my efforts to establish that we ought to have a change of venue. I hired a professor from Florida International University, but to fund his efforts to do a survey, I had to get money from the court because I was appointed as a special public defender.
Public defender. When you say to get money from the court for a survey of what?
A survey of attitudes in Miami, whether or not the prospective jurors, whether the community at large, could look beyond the fact that these people were employed by the Cuban government and render a fair and impartial verdict.
So you wanted money for a survey. What happened?
Well, the question of the money turned principally on how many people were surveyed. And the court cut my request, and I was not able to survey as many people. And then the court turned around and rejected my survey because not enough people had been surveyed.
Is that the survey that I saw that showed there was an overwhelming sense in the broad community of prejudice against anybody, for example, who would work for the Cuban government as an agent?
The overwhelming majority of the community could not be fair.
With the full 11th Circuit reversing and saying they thought that the impaneling of the jury resulted in an impartial trial, why is the case still alive?
My client came back to be resentenced. And he was resentenced. The sentence of life was set aside. He was sentenced to 30 years. And during that period of time, during the passage of years from the original conviction, the media found out about the misuse of the Office of Cuban Broadcasting's monies and the financing of journalists in Miami to spread basically their propaganda message.
So that wasn't known at the time of the trial?
It was not known until many years after.
That they were on government payroll.
That there was government payroll going to journalists in Miami who were writing the articles that were coming out during trial. And that is the issue that is now being litigated in the district court.
Let me ask you, as an American citizen, not as a defense lawyer, did these men get a fair trial?
I do not believe they did.
Why does that matter to you?
Because it corrupts the entire system. You can't have a person charged with criminal activity and having the same government who's prosecuting him paying the journalists who create or encourage the attitude of convict at all costs. I view that as a violation of our Constitution's sacred guarantee that even if you hold unpopular political beliefs, you're still entitled to a fair trial by an impartial jury.
Bill Norris, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is a production of Artemis Common Ground, which is solely responsible for its content. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. Contact us at www.homegroundradio.org.